Hello and welcome to another virtual author event at the Poison Pen Bookstore. I'm John Charles, and today the Poison Pen is delighted to have back virtually with us award-winning author Victoria Thompson, whose new book is Murder on Bedford Street. Before we begin today, for those tuning in, the Poison Pen does have copies of Victoria's new book as well as her previous titles, and we would be happy to connect you with these wonderful books. Just give us a call or go online to the Poison Pen. And now I would like to welcome Victoria Thompson.
Thank you, John. It's always a pleasure to be there. I'd much rather be there in person, but this is the next best thing.
That's true. We would love to have you come back whenever you're in town, but we'll go with this for today. My first question for you is, I'm always fascinated by who the author was before they started writing, because so many writers, that's not what they envisioned their future as being. It's something that they kind of fell into. And you have a rather colorful career background. Can you tell us a little bit about Victoria before you became published?
Yeah, before I became published, I was, when I graduated from college, I had majored in education, so I thought I'd be a school teacher. And I always tell people I'm a retired school teacher. I taught 1 year and retired. So it was not a very good situation. It was middle school, and it was the school was totally out of control, and nobody knew what they were doing. And we moved away shortly after that. And so when I moved, I got a job with the government, printing office. So I was and my title was printing specialist. And whenever my husband to this day talks about someone who doesn't know what they're doing in their job, he said, they're a printing specialist. I knew nothing about printing, but I learned. And so when I had my family, I became a stay-at-home mom. And so I was a stay-at-home mom for a few years, and I was actually babysitting five kindergarten-age kids during the day. And I started reading again for pleasure, because when my kids were little, of course, I didn't have time. And but my kids had gotten old enough then to the point that I could read again. And I started reading Westerns, and that was how I got the idea for my first book, was from reading Westerns. And my first book was a historical romance set in Texas. And so I wrote 20 of those books, and then my historical romance career tanked. That was back when the mid-90s, when they glutted the market with historical romances, and a lot of authors, their sales got so low that they weren't renewed, and I was one of them. So I couldn't get arrested in publisher's row.
We want to let readers know that it's not your fault that you got dropped. It's like in publishing, things come and go in cycles, and I think Western romances kind of have their peaks and their
valleys. They did. They went out of style, essentially, people got tired of them, I guess. So anyway, that was when I had to get a day job, and it turned out I had no idea what I was qualified to do. I certainly wasn't going to go back to teaching school. I saw an ad for somebody to work for a nonprofit as a nonprofit fundraiser. And it turned out that all the skills I had developed from doing volunteer work for writers' organizations translated into fundraising. And so I was very qualified for that. So for 19 years, my day job was being a nonprofit fundraiser. And shortly after I got that job, I sold my first mystery. And it took a while for that to really start making money. So I wrote and worked full time for 19 years, and then I finally retired.
Now, was that first mystery the first in the Gaslight series, Murder on
Astor Place? Yes, it was the first, Murder on Astor Place. It was the first one.
What made you think, okay, I want to write mysteries, because you had come from a background of romance?
Nothing. This is another funny story. I was actually, before I got fired from writing historical romances, I had decided that the next hot thing was going to be romantic suspense. And I was right. It was the next hot thing. They didn't call it romantic suspense, but it was... that's what it was. And And my agent kept saying, I kept sending my agent proposals, and she kept saying, I can't send this out. No one will buy it. and then one day she called me up and said she had had lunch with an editor from Berkeley, and they were looking for somebody to write a series set in turn of the century New York City, where the heroine was a midwife. And was I interested? And at that point in time, by then I hadn't written any, hadn't published anything for a year. And I was like, so desperate to be published. I thought, okay, I was working for the March of Dimes, and some of the volunteers I worked with were midwives. Oh. And my daughter had just started at NYU. So she was in New York. So we had actually walked around Greenwich Village and went in the Barnes and Noble there and bought some books on the history of Greenwich Village just for fun. So I thought, it's kismet. I was meant to write this series. But I will tell you a little secret just between us, that if they had said they wanted somebody to write a series set in medieval Mesopotamia where the heroine was a potter, I would have said, it's kismet. I was born to write this series. But they let me, you know, come up with Sarah's backstory, I invented Frank myself, because I realized that a midwife is not going to be encountering murder people very often in the normal course of her duties, but a police detective probably is. So
it was almost the perfect pairing of detectives, because Sarah, the midwife, has the scientific kind of medical knowledge, and Frank brings in the crime skills that you need.
Yeah. And I like the idea of her. Berkeley actually suggested that she be the poor relative of a rich family, but I realized that she would need to move in all social classes. So I had to make her also from the rich family, so that she could visit Mrs. Astor, or she could visit the tenements, and she could go wherever she needed to go, because Frank can't go to some of those places. So.
Yeah, that's true. Now that brings us to your new book, which is Murder on Bedford Street, and that's the 26th in the Gaslight Mystery Series.
It's backwards, but probably, but that's where it
is. What can you tell those listening in about this latest entry?
This one was really fun because I did become a teacher later in life. In 2000, I started teaching at the Seton Hill University's master's program. They have a master in writing popular fiction. Mm-hmm. So I've been teaching there for 23 years now. And one of my students was a clinical psychologist, and she's very good. She's published several books and all that, but she wanted to write fiction. So she's taking this program to learn how to write fiction. And her villain was a psychopath. And so I was reading her and talking to her. I was reading her stuff and talking to her about psychopaths and psychopathy. And I thought, ooh, this is so interesting. I should write a book about somebody who's a psychopath. So that's where the idea came from for this book. So there was, I had a lot of fun writing it.
And in the book, what is the crime that they're investigating?
Well, in the beginning, the Frank is hired because because this young woman, who's the guy who hires him, is his niece. She's been committed to an insane asylum, and he had been out of the country, and he came back and went to visit his niece and found out she was in this asylum, and so he went to see her, and talking to her, he realized she's not insane. There's nothing wrong with her. She should not be in this place. But of course, getting her out was very tricky. And it turns out her husband had had her committed, which was a possibility. A man could say his wife is crazy. And, you know, at one point, Frank says, how could they have locked her up? But she's obviously not crazy. And Sarah explains that what probably happened is, you know, they send these goons to get her and take her away in an ambulance. She doesn't know where they're going. She's terrified. She's hysterical. And of course, that makes her look crazy. And she tells everyone she's not insane, but Everybody who's insane says that. So it's how do you prove you're not insane? It's pretty hard. And Frank and Sarah try talking to her doctor, and they're like, you know, and he's like refuses to let her out. And they just are trying to help this woman. And this did happen. Not hopefully not with great frequency, but it did happen. I mean, Commodore Vanderbilt, in years earlier than the book has said, had his wife and his son committed just because he didn't like what they were doing, or they wouldn't go along with him on whatever it was he wanted to do. He had his wife put in an assailant asylum, and then later at a different time, he had his son put away because he didn't like the way he was running the business. So it was they were eventually released after a few months. But can you imagine being in an insane asylum when there's absolutely nothing wrong? It's bad enough for people who do have mental illness to be in the places the way they were then.
And wasn't this around the same time that Nellie Bly did her investigative journalism?
Nellie Bly was in the 1880s. Okay. And this is 1901. We're in 1901 in the Gaslight series now. So it was a few years early. I was hoping to use her, but it didn't work out.
What kinds of, I know that you've written 26 entries in the series, so you have that knowledge of the time period and the setting, but each book requires a little bit of something different into the plot. How do you go about researching that? What sources for this particular book did you find most useful? And what surprised you when you were doing the research?
The research, I think, to me is the most fun part of writing these books, is finding that idea. And you're right, each book has to have a hook of some sort, some interesting historical thing that you can hang the story on. And what I do now, and I have a timeline, so I know when the next book's going to happen or could happen. And then I start doing research for that time and find out what was going on at that time. And I read and read and read until I come across something that makes me say, wow, I didn't know that. And if it makes me say that, it's going to make you say that too. So, I get fan mail all the time. Did this really happen? Is this really true? It's like, yes, truth is stranger than fiction. Mm-hmm. So yeah, that's how I research, and that's how I find the thing that makes readers say, wow, I didn't know that.
Yeah. You have written a lot of different mysteries, and you've written two series now, at least to date, that are going strong. I had read something you had written that I found fascinating, and I wonder if you could elaborate on it. When it comes to writing series, you say readers come for the plot, but they stay for the characters. What exactly?
Yes, I always say that, because when I wrote my first book, this is so funny, because I had been a romance writer. And so when I signed the contract to write the mystery series, my editor and my agent and a lot of my friends warned me, they said, mystery readers do not like romance in their mysteries. And I thought, that can't be true. And I thought, I think what they don't like is necessarily sex in their mysteries. But everybody likes a good relationship story, especially if it's, you know, one that can't never be, you know, consummated. So I thought, okay, I have these two great people who were obviously perfect for each other, although they were complete opposites, had nothing in common, and hated each other from the very beginning, which is, of course, a setup for a perfect historical romance. So the hardest thing I had to do was keep them apart in that first book, because I kept wanting them to have a romance, but I couldn't do that. So what was the question?
Readers come to a series for the
characters. Oh, for the characters, save for the characters, yes. And so after I wrote the first book, I started getting fan mail, and people were like, oh, I like the mystery. I couldn't guess who the killer was, blah, 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 blah. P.S. When are Frank and Sarah getting together? Mm-hmm. That was from the first book, every book until they got married. Every fan wanted to know, when are Sarah and Frank going to get together? They, and that, I think, shows how much they love Frank and Sarah. So they bought the book because it was a mystery. Mm-hmm. They bought the second book because Frank and Sarah were in it, and it was a mystery. And, you know, that's why the series is 26 books long, because people like Frank and Sarah. And readers tell me all the time, they say they're like family members. I'm anxious to see what Frank and Sarah are up to this time, what's going on in their life. And that's when you write a series, that's the beauty of it, because you can, you know, tell readers what happened next in their life and show them as they progress.
That's true. One of the comments from one of your fans, I'll inject here because it's kind of timely, is they wanted to know whether you based the asylum in the book, the new book, on a real place, or whether it was.
Yes. Okay. Yes, I did. It had a really long name, but it's now the Metropolitan Mental Health Facility. It's not Metropolitan, Manhattan. But it's still on Ward's Island. It's still there. I don't know if they still use that original building or not, but the building itself was this massive thing, because as I explain in the book, they were built it on the Kirkbride plan. And Kirkbride was a doctor who thought that fresh air and sunshine would cure people with mental illness, which isn't true, although it does help. Yeah. Doesn't hurt.
Better than a dark room and no air. And
yes, locking them away in a solitary confinement or something like that. But, you know, so every room has windows and that can be opened and that people can see out. And it was a beautiful setting. So it was very nice, although the patients were probably mistreated, but still it was, you know, a nice environment. But consequently, the building had to be sprawling because there were no windowless rooms. And so it was a real place. It was a real place. It was where Nellie Bly went, actually. So.
When it comes to your writing process, because you're now writing mysteries, there are certain things I'm assuming you need to know in advance, like who the killer is, how to plant clues. But I've been surprised there are some writers who they just kind of open their document and go. What's your approach to writing the series?
Yeah, when I wrote my romances, I would plot the entire book out chapter by chapter. I knew exactly what was going to happen before I started writing. And but I didn't know what I was doing when I was writing mysteries, so I didn't even know how to do that. I just sort of started and let it happen. Now I have, you know, after all these books, I've sort of worked up a system that works for me, and it works for a lot of other people too, because I teach it. But what I do is I come up with a victim, decide who the victim is going to be, and then I ask myself who and what this person did and why, and then I come up with between 4 and 7 suspects. I usually settle on 5, but you can have as few as 4. You shouldn't have 3, because about halfway through the book, you kill one of them off. And then if you only have 2 people to choose from, that's not very challenging as a mystery. You need at least 3. So I always have at least 4, no more than 7, because the human brain can only remember 7 things. That's why phone numbers are 7 numbers long. So 4 to 7, so people don't get confused. And there's enough suspense. And then they all have a motive, opportunity, and they all have a secret that may or may not have anything to do with the crime, but it makes them look guilty. For example, if, you know, one suspect was with his girlfriend, who also happens to be married to the chief of police, he's not going to be real excited about telling the police that he was with the guy's wife. So he doesn't have an alibi for the murder, and that makes him look guilty. So everybody has a secret, motive, opportunity. And once I know all that, then those are all the clues and all the red herrings. And then I can start writing the book. And I sort of, and from then I'm on like a pantser. I mean, so I'm sort of a cross between a plotter and a pantser. I usually do not decide who the killer is until I'm at least halfway through the book.
So you don't know when you start out. That's interesting.
I don't. And I found that if I know from the very beginning who the killer is, I make it so obvious that I have to change it anyway. Oh. so So yeah, I try not to think of, and not try not to figure it out until I'm into the book.
One of the other things I discovered that about you is that when you were in your, well, during your writing career, you got a piece of advice that I had never heard before and I thought was interesting. I guess it came from David Morrell about identifying your dominant emotion as a writer.
Yes, yes. That was very interesting. And then Jean Ann Krentz has, she actually teaches a class on identifying your core emotion. And when, as soon as she said that to me, I was like, yeah, I know. I know what mine is. Mine is, my core emotion is anger. And which is hard to admit, but true. I'm always angry. And the thing I'm angry about is injustice, which makes me a really good mystery writer, because that's in my books, that we always get justice. That makes me perfect for writing mysteries. So yeah, that was my, my core emotion is anger. And the anger is because the world is not fair. Life is not fair. And I wish it was, but it's not. It's never going to be either, but we can keep trying.
I think that's why people turn to fiction, because the world does not provide them with the
because it does work out. Things, you know, you have happy endings, you have justice prevails, the bad guy's punished.
And yet what strikes me as interesting about historical fiction, historical mysteries, is the more you go back in time and think things are different, the more they seem so relevant to today's world.
It's almost frightening. Yeah. Several times I wrote a book, and then by the time the book came out, something had happened in modern day that was, that mirrored the topic of the book. It was frightening. I got to the point where I was afraid to write about anything. It's like, why am I causing this? But yeah, it's, I always say it, technology is different, but people are still the same. We're still arguing about the same things that we argued about 100 years ago, and, you know, immigration, racism, women's rights. Women can vote now, but still, it's still been 100 years and we're not equal yet.
No, and it seems like women are getting more rights taken away, even as we
see. Yes, it seems to be going the wrong way now. Yeah. Finding Mr. Right was a challenge back then, and it's a challenge right now. So, you know, just all the same things that people are, and like this book talks about mental health, and still, even with all the advances we've made, it's so difficult for people to get help when they need it.
Yeah, so, true.
And they suffer from terrible prejudice, and it's just not a good thing. So there's, you know, everything is still pretty much the same problems that we had before.
That's very wise. In addition to your Gaslight series, you do have another series. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes, this is, it's not really a mystery series. It's more a caper. And it's, my latest book is City of Fortune. And the heroine is a con artist. And in the first book, she's running from a con that went very bad, and the victim is trying to kill her. And so, and she's in Washington, D.C., and it's the summer of the fall of 1917, which was the year that the suffragists demonstrated outside the White House every single day for women's rights, for the right to vote. And by November, the president had gotten really annoyed, and he started having them arrested, and they'd keep them in jail overnight and then send them home. And he thought this would scare them and they would stop doing it. But in fact, it just made them mad, and more women came. So she knows this because she's seen in the paper that the demonstrators are being arrested every day. So she runs to the White House and joins the demonstration and gets arrested with the other suffragists. And instead of just keeping them overnight, this time they sentenced them to 3 months in the workhouse. So she was sent to this horrible place. And while she was there, she became converted to to honesty. She, all these women were, she'd never known women like this before. And they were honest and they really believed in something. And so she becomes a suffragist herself and decides she's going to give up being a con artist. But what she discovers is that she can use her skills as a con artist to help people who, for whom the law will not help them. When they have a problem that the law can't do anything about, she can run a con and get them revenge and make things right. So that's what she's doing in each one of these books.
And each one kind of features a different kind of con, is that correct?
Yes, yes. Each one has a different kind of con. And that's been so much fun researching those. And then, because you have to figure out how it's supposed to go, and then it can go wrong, and what happens when it goes wrong. And then some of the characters tell me they want to be involved, and I didn't plan on that, so I have to figure out how to involve the other characters. And it's just been a lot of fun. And then it's occasionally you'll see in my book somebody in the book will be confused about what's real and what's not real. And Elizabeth will say, "You realize that that's not going to happen." She's like, "Oh yeah, I forgot, I got confused." And that's because I got confused myself. And so I could never be a con artist. I could never keep everything straight. But it's really, really fun to write, and they're fun to read because of that. It's like you get to see behind the scenes, and you get to see what happens and how they do it. And it's just really entertaining.
And it also is that bringing justice back to the world.
It is. And that's my justice thing too. As my core story is justice. And she gets justice for people that the law would never help.
Speaking of keeping things straight, you write two series. Both are in their multiples now in terms of numbers. How do you keep all the details correct and straight? I mean, do you keep a Bible? Do you just kind of know it intuitively? Do you hope it all turns out and then find out you've given someone the wrong eye color in book 10 and have to?
Yeah, well, like John and I were chatting before this started, and I was saying how it's hard to keep things straight, but it's I was saying I had never intended for this to be so long. I didn't know that the series would go on this long. This is kind of success you dream about, but never expect to happen. And so I didn't plan. I don't have a series Bible. And I thought it would maybe be 6 books and I could keep that in my head. But I mean, I did start a timeline finally, because fans would say, "Wait, in what book does this happen?" And I'm like, "I don't know." So I finally made a timeline so I could just say, yes, that's, you know, Myrrh and Chelsea is where it happens. What was this question?
keeping things details straight in a series.
Keeping the details straight. See, this is a perfect example. I can't even keep the question straight. But yeah, I do. I try to keep things straight. But like Frank's son Brian has had 3 different eye colors, and I would not have known that except a fan pointed it out to me and gave me the book and page number for all 3. So, and it's too late to fix that. I'm sorry. So from now on, I think you'll have hazel eyes that change color all the time.
In addition to writing, you teach writing, as you mentioned, in popular fiction and things like that. What is the best piece of advice you give to aspiring writers? Or what would you tell someone who said, "I want to write a book"? What's the first thing they need to know?
Well, when I started, there was nothing. Back in the 80s, there were not even how-to books. It was just, you were sort of on your own. And but nowadays, there are so many resources available on how to write. I would strongly urge people to join a writer's organization for their genre, whatever genre that is, because there's Mystery Writers of America, there's Romance Writers of America, there's Horror Writers, there's science fiction writers. There's organizations for every genre, and I would suggest that you join them, see what they have to offer. Go to writers' conferences locally if you can, and meet other people, meet other writers. And then just write. Writing is like any other skill. The more you practice, the better you get at it. And people often expect to, you know, publish the first book they ever write, and that hardly ever happens. It takes practice, it takes time. And so just write.
What has surprised you? You've been writing now, as you mentioned, for, we won't go into the exact number of years, but for quite a while. What has surprised you about the business of publishing? What, I mean, that you know now that you wish you could go back and tell yourself when you were starting out, this is what to watch out for, this is what you need to know?
The business is very uncertain. When I published my first romance, I thought it would go on forever. My books were selling really well. I was doing very well. And then Western romances sort of went out of favor and my career tanked. And I didn't know that it could end, that suddenly. I knew that my sales had been going down, but it was time for a new contract. And my editor was even surprised. She didn't see it coming. She said that they weren't going to buy any more books from me. And I had to start over. So an important thing to know is that you can do that. Just because you lose one opportunity, if you are talented and dedicated and you are determined to do this, you can change genres, which I did, reinvented myself and became a mystery writer. And the mystery has gone on much longer and been much more successful than the romance.
Smart advice.
Yeah, and the other thing is publishing, traditional publishing is very slow. Everything takes a long time. So just be prepared that nothing happens quickly in publishing.
And yeah, don't be waiting by the mailbox for your royalty check. Is that what you're saying?
Yes. Don't spend until it's actually cleared.
Let's shift gears a little bit and talk about Victoria as a reader. Because if I understand correctly, you were a mystery reader way back, beginning with a series I'd never heard of, Vicky Barr, Stewardess Sleuth, or something like that.
Yeah, most readers have good memories of the Scholastic book sale, that the book fair that they would have at schools. And I remember picking out these books. They were hardcovers, and it was Vicky Barr, and she would, which is people who know me call me Vicky, and she even spelled it the same way. And she was this airline stewardess, which back then was the best job a woman could have, really. I mean, so cool. And when I saw these books, I really wanted them, and I wrote them on my little chart. And then my parents went to the book sale that night, and they came back without the books. And I thought, oh, well, they're too expensive. You know, I wasn't too disappointed. And then Christmas morning, I opened up a package, and there they were. They had saved them to give them to me for Christmas. So I read these mysteries, and they were, I mean, I had read like Nancy Drew and stuff like that, but this was a whole nother level of mystery. So I remember those books so well. I'm not sure that turned me into a mystery writer, but I, you know, it whetted my appetite for reading mysteries. And I've always enjoyed reading mysteries. And all through the years, even when I was writing romance, I still enjoyed reading mysteries and thrillers and those kind of books.
We do have a few more questions from some of your fans. One of the first questions is, How much input do you have when it comes to determining the titles of the books in your series and the cover look? Or is that something that's totally out of your control?
That is one thing that's improved a lot through the years. When I was writing romance, they didn't ask me anything. They send you a form to fill out, like, what is your hero's hair color and eye color? What is your harem's hair color? My husband used to say, yeah, they ask you that so that to make sure that the people on the cover don't look anything like the people in the book, because that was what often happened. You would get the wrong hair color, the wrong eye color. It was just sort of a given that things would not work out. But I picked the names myself of the titles. For the first book, I think I called it Cradle to Grave or something like that, something stupid, just because, I knew that they would change the title. And I went up and to have lunch with my editor and my agent, and the three of us were sitting at a restaurant in New York City, and she showed me my cover for the first time for Murder on Astor Place. And it was so cool. And she said, we need to come up with a title, and we want them all to be sort of the same. And it'll be Murder on Some Street in New York City. That's what the marketing people had decided. So we sat there and brainstormed, and we decided Astor Place was the sexiest street we could think of in New York City. So that was the first book. And so that's how it got started. And then I remember I asked my editor, I said, are we going to make them alphabetical? Because Astor Place, then that would put a little pressure on you if they had to be alphabetical. And she said, no, it's bad enough they were ripping off Anne Perry. We don't have to rip off Sue Grafton too. It's not alphabetical, but it is a street name. And I pick the street names, and I pick the street name, well, once I know what the story is about, so I can, know where to set the story in the city and what street name to use or what neighborhood. Sometimes it's a neighborhood like Chinatown, whatever. And it seems like there was another part of that, the title and the cover. And now they send me for the mysteries, now they send me the cover, and I get to say, can you move the lamppost? Or that looks, crazy. So if there's something that I don't like or want changed, they are very responsive and will fix it. So I've been very lucky with the covers that I do have input on that. And they usually ask me to send them a picture to give them, or pictures to give them some ideas for like what that street looked like, or what that building looked like, or whatever.
I think there's sometimes a misperception about New York City, even back then, that it was just one great big giant monolith, but it was actually more a bunch of little different
Oh
communities
yeah,
or sections or
every
things like
neighborhood
that.
was very different, and they were had set boundaries, and people didn't know anyone in the other neighborhood. You might grow up in New York City and never know anybody outside your neighborhood. It was very common.
Another one of your readers wants to know, do you have a set daily writing routine, or does it change depending on the season or the book?
Well, I try to have, let's just say I try to have it. Of course, if you have a doctor's appointment or something, that screws everything up. But I get up in the morning and look at Facebook and look at my email, and then as soon as I can, I start writing, and I write until I have at least 5 pages. I try to write 5 pages a day, 20 pages a week. So, and I found that that works out really beautifully, because I used to try to write as many pages as I could. But what would happen is I would write until I didn't know what was going to happen next and stop. And then I would have to wait a week without writing anything while I figured out what happens next. So now I find writing at a slower pace that I'm figuring out things further ahead, and I always know what's going to happen next. When I quit for the day, I always know what's going to happen next. So that make it, I don't have as much downtime because I don't have to stop and think for a couple of days while I figure out what happens next. So, and then I, when I finish my 20 pages for the week, if I finish on Thursday, I take Friday off and have a long weekend. That's my reward.
Another one of your readers would like to know, when it comes to marketing your books, do you have certain social media platforms you gravitate to? Do you have a favorite that you find book recommendations yourself on?
I'm on Facebook and Twitter, and Facebook is the one I mainly use. Twitter, I have it linked to Facebook, so what I post on Facebook shows up on Twitter, but I have never figured out Twitter to how to use it or how to get anything out of it. But I'm a faithful Facebook user, so I have my author page there, and I post everything on Facebook.
What's coming up for Victoria as an author? You've just published your latest Gaslight mystery. I'm guessing there's another Counterfeit Lady.
Yeah, I'm working on the next Gaslight, which is Murder in Rose Hill, which is a neighborhood in New York City. And I've finished the next Counterfeit Lady book, which will be out in December. And I'm really excited about it because it tells the story of when the 19th Amendment, which gave women the vote, was finally passed. In order for a constitutional amendment to pass, the House and Senate have to pass it. And then it's sent to the states, and two-thirds of the states must ratify it. And back then that meant the legislature of each state had to pass it. Both houses of their legislature had to ratify the amendment. And they got down, and you'd think, okay, we only need 36 states back then because there were only 48 states. But they got 35 states. 11 states said no, did not ratify it. And that left two states. One of them was in Vermont, and their governor said, I'm not going to even present it to the legislature for ratification. And that left Tennessee. And Tennessee is the last of the southern states. Every single other southern state had rejected it. So if it didn't pass in Tennessee, it was dead. It was not going to pass. And when I read the story of what happened, all the betrayals and cheating and backbiting and backstabbing that happened, it was like I read a nonfiction book, The Woman's Hour, and it was so exciting. It was like reading a thriller, and I knew the outcome. I knew that it was going to pass, but I still was on the edge of it because you just could. I mean, when you see what happened, really happened, you can't imagine how it passed. It was literally the very last possible minute that it passed. But it was such an exciting story. And I thought, what if Elizabeth had a hand in this? Because there was so much cheating going on that it was right up her alley. She's a con artist. So it was like, so Elizabeth goes to Nashville, Tennessee to help the ratification process along with her talents, using her talents. That was such a fun book to write. Scary because I wanted every little detail right. But
That sounds wonderful. And you're right. I mean, it came down to one mother writing to one legislature and saying, you better vote the right way. Women might not have the right to vote for years later. Oh, that's terrific. So that's coming. That's wonderful.
It's coming in December. Yeah.
Readers, I'm assuming, can find more about you and your books on your website, your publisher's
website. Yes, victoriathompson.com, easy as pie.
Well, I can't believe how quickly our time has gone by. We've had author Victoria Thompson here talking about her new book, Murder on Bedford Street, as well as the taste of what we can expect to come. I'd like to thank Victoria for taking time to virtually visit the Poison Pen. And for those tuning in, thank you for joining us on another virtual author event at the Poison Pen Bookstore.
Thank you for having me. It was so much fun, John.
Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.